You're listening to Exploring Boys' Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC that examines current issues affecting boys, teachers of boys and boys' schools. I'm Bruce Collins, Director of Member Engagement. If you caught our last episode, a highlight reel drawn from this year's IBSC online program series, you'll know that 2025 to 26 has been a rich year for the community. And our Exploring Boys' Education conversations have been just as rich. Before we move into season 8 of the podcast later this year, we wanted to bring you the finest bits from season 7. As was true for our online programs, emerging from this season's episodes are three themes. The first is about what happens when educators of boys make deliberate choices about the environments boys habit. Not just the physical spaces, but the structures of the day, the relationships in the room, and the level of trust placed in boys themselves. Melinda Barguana's action research project at Trinity Grammar School began with a simple question: what would happen if boys were given real ownership of something that mattered? Over 8 weeks, 26 boys aged 7 to 12 designed and built a biodiversity pond. What Melinda was really measuring, though, was what happens to boys when they feel a connection to something they built themselves.
One of my boys, he nearly blew me away with this comment when we were doing our reflection, our exit interview, and he said, I used to think about all the negative things that happened in my day, but after building a pond, I now think of all the positive things.
That boy's insight points to something Melinda documented carefully, that purposeful outdoor work co-created with peers is genuinely restorative for boys. It lowers cortisol, reduces cognitive overload, and sends them back to the classroom feeling better equipped to learn. Andrew Martin's recent IBSC study, like we mentioned in the last episode, the largest of its kind, asked a direct question: what do educators actually do that makes a measurable difference to boys' academic and social-emotional well-being? He came to this work, he told us, in part because of his own experience in a boys' school.
I was at an all-boys school, and in those days, students didn't go to parent-teacher night. It was just your parents that went. You sat at home feeling very, very nervous. The year master was actually quite surprised that I had any intention to go on to year 11. I wasn't a bad kid. I lacked motivation. I wasn't listening. I wasn't doing much homework. And back at the ripe old age of, 14 or 15, you don't join the dot. You don't actually connect the fact that if you do no study, you're not going to do very well. I was very fortunate. I was in a family and a home and a school where I could, if I decided to do some study, I'd do okay. And so year 11 and 12, I sort of got back together again. But I know what it's like to be engaged, and I know what it's like to be disengaged. I've been there. And then at uni, I did child psychology, then educational psychology in master's and PhD. And then focusing and funneling into motivation, it always stuck with me as a construct, as a phenomenon that meant a lot to me. It was clear there were gender-related patterns in different facets of motivation. This project was an opportunity to really dive deeply into the boys' side of things in single-sex boys' schools. It's a long way to get to this project, but the backdrop is actually quite authentic. This goes way back for me.
Andrew's data from IBSC schools tells us that the single highest ranked factor in boys' well-being is relational support. The way a teacher actively demonstrates that they know a boy, believe in him, and won't let him off the hook.
Make a point of showing interest in a student. Be clear that you're interested in knowing more about how that student learns. Be very clear to the student about that. So more than just sort of quietly observing how they learn, being a little more overt and explicit about that. Or finding out about a boy's interests and explicitly connecting that to their learning, or is using it as an example in class to switch them on. Being clearer about not giving up on a student and saying, no, I have high and positive expectations for you. Let's give it another shot. I know there's more.
This is not warmth as a personality trait, but relational support as a deliberate, overt teaching practice. And that distinction matters. It means any educator in any classroom or on any sports field can choose to do it. Chris Post, head of the Boys Latin School of Maryland, made a decision, inspired by Jonathan Haidt's arguments, amongst others, that we have overprotected boys in the natural world while underprotecting them in the virtual one. He and his leadership team acted.
Coming out of 2023-24, we had seen a bunch of research, obviously. Richard Reeves talking about the significant isolation that boys and young men were experiencing, and then the work of Jonathan Haidt. And we, as a leadership team, made the decision it was time to give boyhood back to our boys. We can't control the global environment that they're in, but we can control what we can, you know, for the time that they're with us.
That decision led to a school-wide phone ban, a redesigned daily schedule, a junkyard-style creative playground in the lower school, a choice block at the start of the middle school day, and peer-led clubs moved to the morning in the upper school. This connects directly to what Henry Melker, Boys Latin's head of middle school, said about why giving a boy the choice of how to spend the first 40 minutes of his day changes everything that follows.
The point of school, of course, is not to be good at school. The point of school is to be prepared for life. What we try to do in the middle school is really put kids into the driver's seat, and we try to build agency every day. So if for lower school, for example, an important benchmark is by the end of third grade, a boy should be reading to learn, not still learning to read. Hopefully by the end of their time in the middle school here, they're not still learning independence, but they're learning independently. And so really the message that we're trying to send kids is in life, you have options of how you start your day. And it's the same thing here at school. And it matters the choices that you make.
And Amy Wazlowski, head of upper school at Boys Latin, described what happens when you stop scheduling the most demanding learning at the moment boys are least ready for it.
Boys at 8 o'clock are quite different than they're just a little bit later in the day. Trying to have 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds ready for forensic science at 8 a.m. is much different than later in the day. And then what we were noticing is in the afternoon, kids are tired, they're running to sports, they have all these other responsibilities in the afternoon. So how can we create a space in the morning that kind of slowed down their day, but actually started their day more intentionally?
The second theme is harder, going into territory that is uncomfortable but necessary. This is the gap between who the boys present themselves to be and who they actually are. The online threats targeting boys, and also we looked into the sports environments that either build boys up or grind them down. Andrew Reiner, as many of you know, has spent years interviewing boys and young men about their inner lives. He's the author of Better Boys, Better Men, a book many of you have read, and he's been developing a new book based on research into boys' resilience. He told us something that gave me pause for thought.
So much of what I was hearing, Bruce, really ultimately pointed back to struggles with resiliency. I realized that later. There was something else I started to realize, which was that we were doing a great job of working with a 2.0 script when it came to empowering and supporting girls to thrive and succeed, which was wonderful, of course. But I realized we were still working from a 1.0 script when it came for boys.
Andrew brought evidence of what that gap looks like in practice. Through what he calls the mask exercise, one he used during visits to boys' schools in New Zealand, boys draw a mask. Written on the outside is what they show the world, on the inside, what they actually feel.
Let me just say this first about that mask exercise. And what I found, and I've been using it since then to the same effect, which is that it's the most immediate arresting way for any educators in the room and for the boys themselves to see really just how wide the gap is between the ways that they're taught to show up in public and their deeper struggles and this other sense of self that often doesn't see light of day. Many boys are deeply struggling, quietly, often against themselves, with these profound levels of chronic stress, anxiety, depression, self-loathing, believe it or not, confusion and disconnect on their own. It got to the point when I would do this mask exercise where I remember I was standing on a stage and I said to them, you know, what do you think are some of the adjectives that you guys wrote on these masks that that describe the ways that you show up in public. And it was, you know, sporty, confident, going, fun-loving, funny. You know, those are the kinds of things. And then I'd turn it around and I'd say, okay, what do you think's on the inside? And to my surprise, many hands went up and boys said things like scared, confused, lost, anxious. And these were things that they came up with on their own. And they were so self-aware of this double life that they're leading. And what I thought was so important, more for them than for me, was to hear just how common and pervasive these feelings are, this chasm is, because they need to know that they're not alone.
Andrew's argument is that when boys can't bring that inner life into the open with the trusted adults around them, they find somewhere else to take it.
One of the things that often happens in a lot of these manosphere spaces is that there is an acceptance of who they are that they often are not finding offline in large communities. I was driving in the car with my son, and I asked him if he knew about Andrew Tate. He said he thinks he had heard of him, and he pulled up a few TikTok videos of him. And he said, you know, he's got some actually pretty good messages that you tell me. And they were messages about the importance of not spending too much time sleeping, not spending too much time gaming, and going after your goals. Another one was about the importance of being accountable. When you screw up, to take responsibility for it. We can all agree, these are absolutely skills and traits that we want more boys and young men to develop and to embrace. And so there are messages out there that a lot of influencers use that are positive, that absolutely are generative for young men. And of course, there is the flip side. Now, whether or not they're using these positive messages that are very generative, whether or not they're using them to lure boys and young men in, I don't think really we should be splitting hairs on that. It's more about understanding with some compassion and context why boys and young men find themselves there. So I think it's important to understand that it's more complicated than a lot of us realize. A lot of times boys feel that they're being censored. Understandably, well-meaning, well-intentioned teachers and administrators shutting them down when they start voicing things, and that's completely understandable. But I think that in the minds of a lot of these boys and young men, when they're getting censored and shut down, we're basically turning them into the arms of the very men that we don't want them to be raised by. In other more productive spaces, like potentially school, I really do think that that is an antidote to a lot of them going to these places. I really do.
Andrew's four C's offer a practical framework for any teacher: compassion, curiosity, commiseration, and context. Not moralizing, not shutting down, staying in the conversation. Evan Harris, a digital safety and deepfake expert, makes a very similar point about why scare tactics don't work.
The line is blurring. It's disappearing in front of our eyes, the line between real and fake. When we're entering into a world where just noticing little artifacts and patterns of what, you know, identifies a deepfake, when that starts to slip away from us because the deepfakes have gotten so good, the emphasis has to fall on kind of the psychology of how deepfakes affect the brains. When we see something emotional, we're more likely to believe it and more likely to share it. That's true, interestingly, not just for negative emotions like fear and anger, but also for excitement and happiness. It's all these things that kind of short circuit our critical thinking. And in some cases, like scams, get us to act in ways that are not in our own self-interest. And so understanding those red flags is really, really important to protect ourselves as consumers, as citizens in a democracy, as community members in a school. They have to have all that kind of literacy. A quick line I use all the time is, just because the image is fake doesn't mean your impact isn't real. That's a common misconception. This stuff gets marketed to them like it's a prank or a joke.
The impact is real. That's the message that cuts through where warnings don't. And Evan's practical advice for schools, because the deepfake landscape is genuinely alarming, is to think in terms of positive role models rather than just restrictions.
Some of it comes down to just like executive functioning, right? It's taking time to reflect metacognitively about what this would do to another person. I mean, imagine coming to school and having images or videos of you saying something you didn't say or doing something you didn't do circulating. Imagine what that would feel like, just giving them a moment to pause. Because anyone who's worked in schools, we know that so often it's just impulse control stuff. They don't think through the impact of what they're really doing. Identifying those things like, oh, this boy feels like they're falling behind. This boy is dealing with some kind of rejection. This boy has been bullied. Catching those things and having some awareness that these are the types of things that kind of come before some of this other stuff that's much more dangerous. Catching it then, I tend to think, could be really powerful. And I think there's a big role to play for male teachers, coaches, positive male role models. We have to have an equal and opposite sales pitch here.
If the online world is offering boys one vision of what it means to be a man, schools need to offer another. And it has to be just as compelling, just as real. Sports is important in many boys' schools. And Chris Ekron, who spent years leading sports performance at Member School Bishops in Cape Town, South Africa, before moving into sports management at the University of Cape Town and co-founding Playbook ED, is doing exactly that in the context of school sport.
Boys are getting pulled in so many different directions. They all have their sport. They've got tests. They might be involved in a play. And I think, to me, that the biggest challenge around that is that we've got to create an ecosystem of communication between the different role players. And if we try to put the boy back into the center of every decision we make, and we schedule things around that boy or those boys, you know, then boys can achieve in all these elements that he's involved in. You know, what exactly does success mean for you as a school, as a sports department, as a particular sporting code? And then you communicate that to parents, to old boys. This is what we are looking to achieve. This is our process to try to achieve that. And I think transparency again and clear guidelines is key. You know, once we have that clarity and we define what success looks like within our environment, I think then is a less pulling from different directions saying, okay, is this in the best interest of the student's long-term development, long-term growth? Or are we looking at short-term investments for this term or this year?
We all know that not every boy is going to play in a top team. Not every boy is going to pull on national colors. But every boy in your school can be developed if the structures are clear, if the stakeholders are aligned, and if the boy, not the result, is at the center. Our last theme pulls together what all the Exploring Boys Education conversations ultimately come back to. Schools are not neutral environments. Every structure, every policy, every use of space sends a message to boys about who they are and what they're worth. The question is whether that message is the one we intend. Chris Post framed this most starkly when talking about the philosophy behind the boys' Latin changes. His argument about the natural versus the virtual world applies just as much to how we design the physical spaces boys inhabit every day.
What does it mean to be overprotective in the natural world and underprotect in the artificial world? It means preventing boys from experiencing the natural consequences of cause and effect. Learning, you know, the habits of problem solving, team building, the skills of interacting and self-regulating in a way where adults are quick to rush in. I think we have seen that kids' lives are so highly scripted and highly scheduled. There was far more time allotted for unstructured play when I was growing up. And now we just know that that's not the experience that kids typically have.
Melinda's project is a direct counter to that highly scripted and scheduled life Chris mentions. Her green patch, or the boy's green patch, is a space where none of the normal hierarchies apply, where a boy who has never been given a leadership role is suddenly mentoring younger students, and where the measure of success is whether the pond is thriving or not.
It was a deliberate action for these boys to be able to look after the younger ones and mentor them to build not only their self-confidence, but the younger boys' self-confidence, to impart those leadership skills in them, to learn how to build relationships, not only with the peers in their cohort, but to their mentees that they had to look after. And that, as I was saying before, created a band of brothers. One of them gave me a quote, and it said, it's our place. It's a place of comfort, kindness. It's relaxing and fun in nature, and it's full of biodiversity. So they love this space and they want it to thrive. And that's part of their flourishing. When they see their space thrive, it makes them thrive.
That sense of shared purpose at the pond is also what Anna Louise Simpson and Kerry Oldman have been building deliberately between two Melbourne schools that are only 700 metres apart. Anna Louise is the head of Wadhurst at Melbourne Grammar School, and Kerry is the middle school executive director and acting principal at Melbourne Girls Grammar. They both believe deeply in single gender education, and they believe equally in what happens when boys and girls encounter each other's perspectives in a structured, safe way.
We both passionately believe in single sex education. We know why it exists. We know what it offers our young men and our women, but we also know that our boys and girls go off to a co-ed world and we have to give them opportunities to engage with each other meaningfully.
One of the tools they use is what they call a values walk, a physical activity where boys and girls move across a room to signal agreement, neutrality, or disagreement with statements that begin lightly and get harder.
We start off with, again, some pretty low-key stakes engagement. So we have an icebreaker and values walk. We get them all standing up in a room, nothing like movement to help us. And we start off with something simple like, ice cream is better than chocolate. Where does everyone move to? And then, you know, the questions get more and more challenging. Adults make too much fuss about online safety. Female athletes should be paid the same as male athletes. And this is a really great way for us to see the dynamics of the groups. It's really interesting to see where people stand.
From a girls' school side of things, it's just the different perspectives that the girls get, and I think the boys as well, because I think when you're in a single-sex environment, you're bouncing ideas off each other, but you only know the space that you're in. But I do think that the learning goes both ways. It's really important to bring them all together to then actually be able to step out of that co-ed space and go back to their reciprocal schools and be able to say, that made me feel uncomfortable. Oh, I was unsure about that. So they go back into their own environment where they can then unpack it a little bit more in the classroom as well.
They also go to lengths to ensure the conditions for this collaboration are genuinely safe, including knowing the limits of what teachers and leaders in schools can facilitate alone.
We know average age that boys are seeing pornography is 13. So for us to not have those conversations with them is naive. I think part of this also is accepting the limits of our professionalism. So we have partnered with a healthy relationships organization that have decades of experience in this space and research to support that.
That's what a deliberately designed space produces. Not a program, not a policy. A boy who has been seen, challenged, and trusted, and who comes home changed by it.
I guess recognizing how important it is for trust to be built in that kind of environment is huge. Communication in that environment between the girls and the boys, and really how they have to rely on each other in that space when they don't necessarily have a teacher accountable for everything that they're doing. And they really thrive when we get feedback from parents. They basically say from Monday to Friday, they have a different child come home on the Friday.
One through line remains. Boys flourish when the adults around them are deliberate. Deliberate about the environments they design, deliberate about the relationships they build, deliberate about the pressures they name and the conversations they are willing to have. Believe it or not, this is the 90th episode of Exploring Boys' Education. That number means something, not because of what it says about the podcast, but because of what it says about this community. Every download represents an educator somewhere in the world who chose to spend their commute, their lunch break, or their evening learning something that might make them better for the boys they teach. Thank you all for that. Season 8 is coming later in the year. In the meantime, every episode since launch of Exploring Boys Education is available on all major podcast platforms. If these highlights have pointed you towards an episode you want to hear in full, they're all there waiting. Until next time, keep on championing boys' education.